For decades, he refused to allow documentary makers or biographers to tell his story. But finally, fashion legend Pierre Cardin has entrusted his personal and professional story to an American couple of devoted fans.
You know, it's very important that he was the first designer to get into diversity, because designers have that power to globally inspire millions of people.
How many million dollars did this man make last year? His name is Pierre Cardin.
Well, earlier I spoke to the directors of House of Cardin, P. David Ebersole and Todd Hughes, and asked them how they would go about describing Pierre Cardin.
I would say a sheer genius. This guy just is so extraordinary, yet so human. He is so down to earth. His common sense is extraordinary. And it's just very interesting when you meet someone whose mind is so complex and to see that they are really just people who don't give up, right?
Yeah, he was determined.
Yeah, David, 70 years.
Yeah. David, how would you describe him?
I think especially after making the documentary, I would say inspirational, because he's one of those people that inspires you to want to create. Like, once you've watched what he's done and how he's lived his life and how he's dedicated it to what he loves and believes in, you sort of get yourself in this mode of saying, well, you know, I might even be middle-aged, but I can still do all these things that I have, like, sort of on the plate that I still want to do. And it's just about kind of committing to your creativity and going for it. So, yeah, he inspires me.
Did he need persuading to give permission for this documentary to be made? I mean, I'm assuming that he you know, is 100% behind it.
He has always said no. Apparently, several documentary makers have approached him in the past, and he said no to all of them. And he collaborated on a biography about 10 years ago, 15 years
right,
ago,
yeah,
that at the last minute said he didn't want published. So what was very odd was that we just wanted to meet him because we just, you know, were huge fans of his. And yes, we were documentary filmmakers, but he kind of said yes to us as soon as we walked in the door. So it was kismet. His team did persuade him after he had said yes that we were the right people to do this with, because we're great fans and would show him a lot of respect.
That's a great privilege.
Matthew Gonder, who's in the film, who's also the executive producer of the film along with us, he was our liaison to the world of Cardin. He's the American brand ambassador. We don't speak French, so he navigated everything for us and kind of kept everything on the rails. Otherwise, I don't even know if we would have been able to do it. We just speak schoolgirl French, we say. Like, we just we kind of fumble our way through où est l'autobus and things like that.
Well, one of the descriptions of him from someone I assume who knows him was control freak. So once this agreement had been reached, and what a responsibility to get, did he set down any rules for you?
Absolutely none. He gave us complete access to his archives. His staff were all so helpful, and everyone was so into this project. And, you know, people I think might have admonished us, like, oh, he doesn't like that, or I would stay away from that, but really nothing. And one of the reasons I think he did choose us was that we were a gay couple, and so obviously, he's never really talked about his relationship with Andre Oliver, so we, in a sense, were outing him for the first time. And so we were very cautious, but clearly we did a good job because he is behind the film 100% and said everything in it was true.
We gave him what we call meaningful consultation in the contract, and insisted that we had final cut, because we knew that doing something that was so close, an authorized documentary, meant that we had to at least have some ability to say, but this is the movie we want to make and we want to say these things. But all he did was watch the movie once at a close to finish rough cut, And they had a few comments that actually really helped the movie, about just a few different kinds of ideas, especially about the ending. And that was it. I mean, they didn't quibble with any of the details or anything that we put together.
He had a great start working with Jean Cocteau and Christian Dior, but the pride in his face when he goes to, in his museum, that red pleated coat, that he said, this is when I became Pierre Cardin. Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. I love that moment. There's so many moments in the film. People talk about how we are dealing with a man who's private to some extent, and that, you know, people even within the film talk about him being an enigma, but we feel like he's constantly revealing himself. So he's letting you see who he is through action and through what he does. He doesn't necessarily sit down and tell you, you know, his feelings about this or about that, but you can watch him in action and see all the different things over time. He's been in the public eye for, you know, close to 70 years, and he's been on film since, what, that Dior footage that was shot in what year, Todd?
1945.
1945. So we had access to archival materials that show him all the way through his entire life and show him as a very consistent person with very similar ways of talking about his life, his art, himself. So we feel like it's extremely revealing. It's funny when people talk about how they feel like he's still holding his cards close to his chest, because it's moments like that, or moments like when he cries at the theater when he's watching a rehearsal, or when he's walking into Sotheby's and a fan stops him and says, what a beautiful show, and he turns around and says, thank you, with all his heart. We keep feeling like he's constantly revealing himself.
Well, I got from that moment again with the red pleated coat, just come back to it because it's such a pivotal garment for him. But not only that's when he became a designer, Pierre Cardin, but he was very proud. He was told it couldn't be made because the fabric was too thick, and he overcame that.
Yeah.
And then he goes, 200,000 sales in the United States alone, you know, where the businessman comes out of him.
It's true. That side of him that is what everybody else speaks about now in retrospect, that besides being such a great fashion designer, he was an amazing businessman.
And although we did not ever find him to be concerned about money in the least, spending it or making it, but it was just the sheer joy of achievement, like, right, like 200,000.
It was always like that.
It was never like, I have the most cake, or...
It was a lovely moment. You mentioned before that earlier...
He always kind of kept that exuberance, too, I think, that sort of almost childlike exuberance of, like, that he goes back to the moment of remembering that he sold 200,000 coats. You could see it in him.
You mentioned that early film footage, which was great, but I have to say I was very taken by that little black and white photograph of him as a boy. It's beautiful and looking so directly at the camera. I love that image of him.
It's the one that's written Pierre on the photo itself, actually. And we got that from his family, right, Todd? That came from...
Yeah, there was a family folder.
Yeah, but I mean, it was from the Fauchons, is that right?
Not that one.
Okay, I thought that one was. But there's very little, when you think about it, you know, a family like that was so split apart, that didn't get to, you know, hang on to their earthly goods, their worldly goods, when they fled the fascists and ran from Italy to France. They didn't necessarily get to keep and take all of those kind of treasured family memories, and so there's very little of those early years. And so it's really remarkable to have that photo.
The timing was perfect for him also. The 1950s to 1963, I love that little segment where you say all the fashion houses had the same vibe. You know, women went out with gloves and a hat, and they wore a coat, and then they had a dress for lunch, and then they had a cocktail dress, and then they had an evening dress. I can't even imagine that. But it was quite a time, wasn't it, the 50s to 1963, crazy times.
Yeah.
I think, too, what's so fascinating about him is that although he's clearly a genius with his clothing design, you know, he kind of conquered that and then went after men, then went after children, then went after your house, right? He just was never content. He was always looking for a new challenge.
But it is interesting. He's a man of, he's both a man of his times and a man who reflects his times. He has a great quote that says, "Fashion is an X-ray of society," and that the world was changing so much right then, that the youthquake was going on, that kids were taking to the streets with fashion, not necessarily just to look different, but actually to challenge the status quo. What young people were doing and looking like in the 60s was exactly an affront to this, you know, culture that had established itself for so many years. And he was right there and in those trenches and mirroring it back at them and elevating it, which is what we noticed that he came in to do. Mary Quant may have been there to do it in the streets with the kids in London, but Cardin took it and brought it up to a level that was new.
You talk a lot about this move that he had to the ready-to-wear and the consequences for him, and there were severe consequences for him. There's a lovely film of him at the time saying, what's the point of designing garments if no one wears them? Or, you know, essentially they're only worn on the catwalk, you know? I mean, that was a business mind, but also that's a democratic mind. Not everyone could carry off the look, let's be honest, but he did want his garments to be worn.
Well, and he was, unlike everybody else that is a designer of that time, a man from, you know, meager means. He comes from a poor immigrant family and works his way up into Paris couture, where everyone else that's designing comes from the world that is buying couture. So he naturally had this affinity towards different people, people of the street, people of his own culture, and thought, why isn't not just fashion for everybody, but why isn't self-expression for everybody? But we find with Pierre, there's always like a little bit of politics underneath each decision. He is intuitive. He does just decide, this is something that I want to do. But on the other hand, he also is willing to challenge a world that he was not a part of.
When you were looking through, and I mean, there's so many riches when it comes to the images that you have, the stills and the films, what struck you about those garments, particularly for the 1960s? You talk in the documentary that the 60s were kind of waiting for a great transformation, and here he comes, you know, with all these ideas and this, yeah, the colour and the cut and the deconstruction and these kind of radical ideas. But as you were looking through those kind of early garments, what do you think?
Well, freedom is the first thing that comes to mind. And even that idea that you were speaking of, that people, women especially, men too, though, I mean, were being forced into certain uniforms and ways that they had to look in order to belong to the culture. And so women had all of those, you know, changes, and that they were set up to just be these sort of little dolls running around in perfect dresses for perfect occasions, and men were in these sort of stuffy suits, and they weren't allowed to have any sexiness or be who they were, express themselves. And then along comes this, you know, this designer who says, wait a second, what if you can be whatever you want to be? What if it's the space age and you can be optimistic and look to the future and think everything could change? So he really was the right man for the moment.
And his futuristic vision looks great today. You know, it's as his nephew points out, he was designing for a future that was 50 years from when he was doing it, not just a couple years. And as Pierre said in the Vogue interview, you know, Yves Saint Laurent was giving him grief, saying, oh, he's such a futuristic designer, I don't think we'll see his designs in a year. And Pierre is still designing. So,
well, there's a nice moment, isn't there? There's that story about the photograph of the two of them, these great creative geniuses, and it's been and it was found ripped up. Yeah. So they've got a history, those two.
Yeah. Well, I think it's mostly with Pierre Berger, who was the head of the Chambre Syndicale, and he was the one who kicked Pierre out. And then the next year, Saint Laurent, his boyfriend, did ready-to-wear. So that's what Pierre was dealing with.
Why did Pierre Canin get, as I mentioned before, such grief when he went into Ready to Wear. Why was the haute couture world so shocked and outraged? I don't think they were that impressed when he expanded his range to include fashion accessories as well, that business side of things. He really was on the outer then, wasn't he?
I think it's sheerly because he was the first. He decided to do something differently, and everyone said, how dare you? And he got slapped for it, and then it became the norm.
Well, there's also that great cartoon that gets shown in one of the sequences that's talking about it, where the lady of the house is stepping out of her limousine with her chauffeur in her outfit, in her dress, and then she sees her concierge wearing the same dress on the street. And she almost faints. She falls over fainting. So I think it was that they were so used to being able to create differences in levels and tiers of society to be able to say, we're different than you, we're above you, you don't get to have what we have. And so it was a revolution.
House of Karan is on in cinemas now. I was talking to the directors P. David Ebersole and Todd Hughes.